everyone. I'm Kate Banskyke, editor of Gonzaga Magazine. And in this special episode of Gonzaga Chat, I'll be visiting with a legend well known to many, not just at GU or in Spokane, but across the region and in many tribal communities where his career took off as an expert in Indian education. A professor here for 36 years, primarily in the School of Education, this iconic Zag was the university's first chief diversity officer and a founding member of GU's Institute for Hate Studies and the Spokane County Human Rights Task Force. He is none other than Raymond Reyes. Raymond, it's a great pleasure to be on the other side of this mic. For this podcast, given that you invited me to be a guest on your podcast when you started intercultural yoga, and we're inside Foley Library's rare book room, which faces the river. You chose this place because you said, "The ancestral memory of the Spokane River has always inspired my time at GU. It embodies the past, present, and future in its relationship with the first people of this area." And I would say it's also an appropriate place for a great discussion with one of Gonzaga's most rare sources of inspiration, to which you have been to countless people over three decades. To our listeners, I want to say that while Raymond's list of accolades and accomplishments is impressive, we won't be regaling those in our limited time today. Instead, our conversation will focus on just four questions. And if you know Raymond, you know how much could be said in four short answers. With that, let's get started.
Okay.
So Raymond, you have said that one of your favorite quotes is from Margaret Wheatley. "Everything is a bundle of potential waiting to be activated through relationship." Tell us more about why this resonates with you so much.
I think what it means to be human is to be in relationship with other human beings. What another favorite quote that I have is by Fritz Perls. He's the father of Gestalt therapy. And he talked about, "Through the face of another, I am." So I think it is, I know that it is in relationship that we get a deeper dive into our essence and who we are and who we're meant to be. It's almost a way of inviting in gentle ways, greeting our potential and then activating it in relationship with others. So there's a fellowship, and it's really consistent with the Jesuit tradition of accompaniment, walking shoulder to shoulder with a companion to manifest a greater good. In the dance of that relationship.
Ooh, that's beautiful. I imagine those relationships come to mind when you looked through some of the images that I sent to you. Images from your journey here that represented moments in the classroom with students, time abroad in Zambia, and you frequently in a pensive state of solidarity during times that folks on our campus were responding to local, national, and worldly incidents of racism. So tell us when you looked through some of those images that I sent that represent more than three decades of your life, what kind of feelings did those photos evoke and what stood out to you?
Oh, wow. I love words. So words came to me as I looked at those images. I think that in Greek, the word image means a moment's intuition into reality. And so these images of my life, the last over 30 years, words like curious, in fact, I wrote them down to myself because I was wanting to see what would stir inside of me. The word curious, caring, creative, collaboration came to mind.
Ooh.
Passion for the possible came to mind, came to heart, came to being. Anybody with the name Raymond Reyes will like alliterations, and I like alliterations. So I just gave you a bunch of C words.
I love those.
Curious, caring, creative, collaborative, collaboration, and of course, passion for the possible. Those are the things that stirred in me when I looked at those images and kind of walked down my historical past and followed the footprints that has led me to this moment.
Mm. Would you like to share a few of those moments that you've been ruminating on as you approach your retirement?
Well, the classroom, I mean, I think that when I was younger here in the 1980s, late 80s, early 90s, I taught a lot of classes. I was blessed to be adopted by different academic departments and teaching across disciplines. always inclusion and equity and belonging being at the heart of it, intercultural competence, but contextualized in different disciplines like sociology, philosophy, religious studies, education, leadership studies, and even the School of Business with the MBA program, the entrepreneurship program that we have. So I think at the heart of it was why we're here, is the teaching and learning process and the magic that happens in a classroom with students. And not only is it me teaching, but it's them teaching and me learning as well. So it was a place where I practiced becoming and being a lifelong learner. And the more I did that, I felt the better I became as a teacher. And I just loved looking in the students' eyes and watching light go come into being through their gaze in thinking about what we were doing or what we were discussing. And I was really activity-based in those days. I liked contextualizing content through process. So pedagogically, I wanted to create an environment, a set of conditions that learned by doing, getting them engaged, not only just talking and not only being a talking head, but doing exercises that became metaphors and analogies for concepts and principles and theories that I wanted to convey to them. So teaching is at the heart of my experience at Gonzaga when I think about it. Oh, there were other things too as well.
Mm-hmm.
It was a place to create when I listed and reflected upon it. And I want to say this, and it's important for me to claim this. This is not about me. This is not about first person pronoun. This is not about I. This is about we and us. This is about the immersion of being in community, being in fellowship with others, kindred spirits. Mm-hmm. They wanted to manifest and incarnate the Jesuit ethos here down mm-hmm. by the river.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was blessed to be involved with a lot of things that were created. I can't take credit for the creation, but my fingerprints are on it. In fellowship with many, many others.
Mm-hmm.
And then it all started back in 1988.
I think you eloquently expressed your desire for this to not be about you, but about the we. When you mentioned that in teaching, you were also learning. Can you recall any specific incidents or maybe just the overall feeling of what you gained or learned through the teaching process as you watched that light in your students?
I did, and I wrote them down because I taught a class last semester, and I wanted to distill the golden tongue wisdom, the essence of what I have learned as a teacher, you know? And I called it harvesting lessons learned to collect your wisdom and nourish being teacher as learner. And so one of the things is falling in love with my why questions, knowing that why illuminates our assumptions. And one of my, I'm fond of acronyms and words. So SIN, S-I-N, stands for me, self-inflicted nonsense. So when we fall in love with our why questions, I think what it does is it manifests in light of day our sins, our self-inflicted nonsense, our judgments, what we generalize about, what we assume, and practicing unconscious exclusion, you know, being able to take some responsibility for what we're doing and what we're not doing. So I think that falling in love with the why questions do that. The other thing I learned was follow the roar. When I went to Kenya, they had talk about how many of the animals, when they hunt, the older lions will be in one area and they roar. And so what happens is the animals that are being hunted by the younger ones, they're on the other side. So say they're on the east side. So when the older one roars, the animal runs the opposite direction towards the hunter, towards the young ones, it'll take them down.
Mm.
So I think following the roar means for me is much like being like buffalo, coming to love your courage and face your fears. When there's a storm, most animals here again run the opposite direction, just like the following the roar. And so I want to be like buffalo, and I've learned to face things. James Baldwin talked about not everything you face changes, but nothing changes unless you face it. So I've learned that in the classroom from my students. This one I really, it's about Wile E. Coyote and cartoons. When walking on thin air, walk on thin air like wild coyote, chasing the roadrunner. Remember that asking for help is our medicine. The power of vulnerability grants us the gift of conscious competence. Mm-hmm. So I like the idea that doing extraordinary things and not realizing you're doing it because you're so occupied doing it. And just like Wile E. Coyote going over the edge and walking on thin air, and keeps on walking on thin air until what does he do? He looks down, and when he looks down, gravity works and he falls. Mm-hmm. So I like those moments, those golden moments when I'm totally present. There's no past, there's no future, there's just the eternal now. Mm-hmm. I'm walking on thin air, man, and it's beautiful. And as long as I don't bring attention to it, I don't look at it directly, I can continue to do it. It has enduring, sustainable value in my life. Mm-hmm. But as soon as I'm conscious of it, it evaporates. And then, just like Wile E. Coyote falling, you know, it does happen that way. The other thing is, and this is a short one, is just busting the binary. Interrupting and disturbing the either or proposition and going for the end both. Mm-hmm. Boldly saying, it doesn't have to be either or. It doesn't. We live in the binary. I get that this third stone from the sun, Earth, is the place of the binary. Male, female, you know, light, dark, good, bad. I mean, I'm exaggerating the simplicity of great complexity, but that's basically terra firma on planet Earth. And so I think it takes a conscious act to interrupt or disturb or bust the binary and go from either or to end both. Mm-hmm.
I would imagine that all of those things that you just talked about, even though you were initially framing that from the context of the classroom experience with students, also those things must have woven themselves deeply into your pathway as being a leader in DEI work. And I know that the work of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the higher ed setting is painfully slow. And challenging. And I know that there were times that you felt like you were on an island with one or two other folks helping to do this work. Mm. And you expressed one time that, you know, there were definite times of feeling burned out and losing your sense of hope, especially when you received too much negative energy about things not changing fast enough. So I want to know, how did you cope with that frustration? Knowing how important the work is, but also how painfully slow it would be. And how did you reconnect with your source of hope to revive your spirit and continue that work?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, in a sense, my saving grace, and I mean this humbly, okay? I don't quite understand its implications, only to say that I've always focused on the idea that culture is a way of life that allows us to walk the spiritual path with practical feet. And always fought thinking about diversity, inclusion, equity, belonging, human difference itself as a living curriculum that allows us to learn the lessons in that of love and service. So I would focus on the spiritual significance of human difference. Mm. I mean, there's an animation around the law and ethical and moral imperatives and the business economic propositions. And I get all the motivations and reasons why this is important body of work. But down at its aquifer, down at its essence, at the center of gravity, is this notion of it is a beautiful way to learn about your relationship to God. Or if you're an atheist, mm-hmm. your relationship to the creative self, or what William Blake called divine imagination. Mm. You know, so I always would focus on the spirit of the moment, and this might sound kind of weird, not weird, but I'll just say it out loud anyway. Sometimes I would hear voices. I mean, and I would have impulses. I would feel something, or I would see something in my mind's eye, or I'd what some mystics call the sweet whisper, and I would hear something, and it was comforting that there was this place, this matrix, or this beautiful moment where the visible and the invisible, the physical and the metaphysical come together. And I happened to be a witness to that moment. So I guess what I'm saying is, whenever I was having a St. John the Cross moment, the Dark Night of Soul, in this work, something would be revealed. I would either see something that really wasn't there, supposedly, or hear something. And it gave me comfort that things are bigger than we think. Mm-hmm. And it's not about us, or it's not about our perceptions and our interpretations of things. But we're not alone. And sometimes those moments, those extraordinary moments, were comforting, but also they became a bridge or a scaffolding or an entree to meet somebody in physicality that would help me with ideas, with energy, with time, with money, with opportunity, with connections with other people, a network. I've loved my time in Spokane. I first came to this area in 1974, and I was very engaged in my early years at Gonzaga. Not only was I doing things on campus, you know, you're young and you have a lot of energy. And so I was all over the place, but it was playful, because I was constantly invited to create things. So it was happening on campus, it was happening in Spokane County, in the city, this regional area. And to answer your question, the real soul food that I knew I was making a difference is when I got threatened. Ooh. I used to get threatened when they first announced that I was the CDO at Gonzaga in 1978, when Father Spitzer came at the same time that I was appointed as the Chief Diversity Officer. Him and I first started together in our new roles at about the same time, the same month. And I got somebody had put threatened my life with a piece of paper written while it was print written on my car. They knew it was my car. And so I had gotten threats before, either, telephone, voicemail, or notes on my car. And at first I was concerned about that, but then I thought to myself, no, you're on the right track. You're threatening people, the ones that need to be put on notice that we will not tolerate this in this regional area. Mm. In fact, there was a thing that KSPS did. It was called Extreme Tolerance. Why Richard Butler? I remember being on a panel. I'm going Free Associated here now, so humor the old man. I distinctly remember. God, it must have been 87, 88. It was when the law school was in an elementary school, mm-hmm. where across the street here on Boone, that's where the law school used to be, mm-hmm. before they built the building. And there we had a panel discussion, and Richard Butler showed up. He was one of the people.
I did not know that.
This was a long time ago. And boy, he looked at me like he hated me with disdain, you know. I tried to remember the Anthony DeMello line. Yeah, and these are things that helped comfort me in these dark times. Anthony DeMello said, you know, that human beings have difficulty doing three things: respond to hate with love, mm-hmm. Include the excluded, and admit you're wrong when you're wrong. Mm. And I wanted to respond to his hate with love, but not in a condescending, pejorative, egocentric way where I was trying to project being better than him, but a genuine love that comes from the soulful essence of the divine, you mm-hmm. know, because I'm a chip off the old block, mm. made in image and likeness of God, the incarnational view of God. So if that's the case, we call God creator, then I can be creative. And so in those moments, trying to give him the creative love, mm-hmm. Trying to include him, even though he was excluding himself by being hateful. And so those are times that I found reinforced or comforted me and protected my tendency to get melancholy, mm-hmm. or get depressed, mm-hmm. or feel defeated. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what a beautiful response to a man that, for the sake of any of our listeners who might not know the name Richard Butler, he was head of the Aryan Nations compound in North Idaho, which of course Gonzaga partnered closely with others in the region in Kootenai County and Spokane County in helping to deal with that situation. And you were kind of playing inside ball at that time, weren't you?
I was, and I'm going to say Bill Wasmith and others and Tony Stewart, and there were so many other people. The list goes on. So that's what I mean, many hands make for light lifting, and it just wasn't about me. It was about a community of activists that were involved in those days, because Order 1 and Order 2 were alive and well. People were getting killed. There were shootouts. There was violence. People were threatened. Mm-hmm. And so it was hardball. It was the real deal. Mm-hmm. But people persisted. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think love prevailed and prevails mm-hmm. to this day. And it's really interesting that here we are 36 years later, 40 years later, in my instance, being in Spokane, it'll be 50 years in June 2024, and I first came to this area, so 50 years ago. And, you know, we're still struggling with the same issues. And so, you know, the Center for Hate Studies is a very important initiative. I mean, all our initiatives are. Mm-hmm. Anything that we can do to close the gap between rhetoric and reality, mm-hmm. between promise and practice, between what is versus what should be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, a big part of your work, aside from major programs, getting back to your idea of this relationship building, and being a facilitator of the IDI work and helping people to see inside themselves mm-hmm. what those instances of rhetoric are and how to eradicate that. What part of that has been most enjoyable for you? Because it's tough work.
Yeah, that's interesting you say that, because yesterday, the first time I got certified for the Intercultural Development Inventory, the IDI, was in 2002, 2003. Went to Portland and got certified by the two architects of the instrument itself, Mitch Hammer and Milton Bennett. There's been three versions of the instrument in the last 14 years. But just recently, just yesterday, I interpreted an IDI for a colleague here at Gonzaga, because our now Chief Diversity Officer, Robin Kelly, has an Academy in the Inclusive Excellence, and part of the curriculum is to take the IDI. And so I've just finished doing 12 interpretive debriefs with colleagues, faculty, and staff here at Gonzaga. And I love it, because it's almost like a spiritual exercise where you're using the power of reflection to kind of reflect back to the person how they experience human difference without blame, victimization, or guilt. I mean, it's just a pristine opportunity, I hope, in a safe way to do that reflection, that deeper dive about how do we interact with human difference across the various social identities, not just race, ethnicity, and culture, but all the social identities. Everything under the blue dome that makes us different as human beings. Mm-hmm. So the IDI is one instrument. There's been so many things. I've been thinking about that. In fact, I've made a list, and I think I got up to 27 or 28 different initiatives. Some of them are still here. Some of them have died on the vine, which is fine. But all the things that we've done at Gonzaga, we've done a lot. We've come a long ways. We have a long ways to go. Mm-hmm. One of the bumper stickers I saw a long time ago, it said, "Diversity is a journey, not a destination." Only to say it's a process, and it's a marathon. It's not a 100-yard dash. It's not a process that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's an enduring proposition of opportunity and potential, because that's how we're wired. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, in groups, out groups, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I saw that in Zambia when I went there, watching our students get out of their comfort zone and learn how to do the adaptive response, because that's the hallmark of intercultural competence. Mm-hmm. That's the basis of IDI, is how do we cognitively and behaviorally shift in accordance with the cultural context and bilocate our own sense of cultural identity and values, so we're not surrendering or or sacrificing the integrity of our own beliefs, but being able to find that place of malleability where the conditions change. Mm. They say that water boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit. You change the conditions, you change the climate. So how do you change your consciousness, which is a condition of behavior, so you can become more inclusive and have a greater sense of belonging?
Mm. Well, I know for me, having only been here 10 years to see, you know, a decade of your work in action, what I have loved to see is your ability to push those really difficult processes in a way that doesn't, at least largely, turn people away from it. I mean, I think of things like productive discomfort. Even that phrase productive discomfort is something that people instinctively want to back away from. But I think you presented those things as opportunities for bettering ourselves as individuals and collectively. And so it was more received.
It is personal, because I think that you can't give what you don't have. And I think people in this work need to always be working on themselves. So I would like to believe that I've done that in my life, not only as a teacher in terms of the earlier discussion we had about lifelong learning, but also I'm constantly on my proverbial learning curve around self-awareness. Where are my blind sides? I can't see the back of my head. So how can I be in fellowship with someone that helps me see my areas of blindness? And some of it has to do with the comfort zone, our comfort zone. I often say this to students. I said something to the effect, and I don't know where I got this, but this idea that what does a fat snake on a hot rock have any intrinsic motivation to move? It's only when we're uncomfortable that we're inspired to move. Even the word, emotion has a word to emote, to move, or motivation to move. You know, and so the conditions change, and we're either externally motivated to move to or internally. So I think it's important to self-initiate that kind of movement in us, either cognitively, affectively, or behaviorally. Mm-hmm. And that, it is a head, hands, and heart thing. In fact, I used to, in the old days, do a goofy thing about to know, to care, to act. You know, the idea to know the power of relationship, to care about what you know and make it relevant, and to act upon what you care about out of respect. Mm. And I would proposition people, even jail weekend, this past weekend, I talked to the students and talked about, you know, the Gonzaga Jesuit education, liberal arts education, is not only going to class in the traditional three R's, reading, writing, arithmetic, or critical thinking, or being able to speak eloquently, you know, write well, but it's also about relationship, relevance, and respect. Mm. Relationship to self, to others, to God, to the earth. It's much like the beloved community that Martin Luther King talked about, mm-hmm. in terms of the beloved community, and it's about relationship that I've just mentioned, mm-hmm. to self, to God, to others, and to the earth. And then to make it relevant, the words of the common ground, and then, of course, to act upon that commonality with great diversity by respecting the other, whoever the other is.
This question may be the hardest. Are you ready? So as you reflect on your life's work, what are some moments of pride or satisfaction?
The first things that come to mind, I cited a few. I think in 1993, with a group of students, we established HERO, the Helping to Educate Regarding Orientation. And that became one of the first seeds of germination and potential for what is now the Lincoln Center. Mm. That we established, we wasn't even called the Lincoln Center, it was the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender Resource Center. And we established that in, I think it was 2004. And I would say, both audaciously claim that we were the first Jesuit college university in the United States to do so. So we had some courage. We were early adopters to the CDO position as well, by the way. Mm. So we've always been, I think, and I don't mean this in an egotistical way, but in a way that says we've been on the learning curve in front of things, in front of movements. We've been innovative. We've been on the cutting edge of things at times. So I'm proud of that. And I think also establishing the GIOP program, the Gonzaga Indian Education Outreach Program, which became the earlier kind of incarnation of eventually writing the position that we have now for Director of Tribal Relations and populating that with some FTE and the commitments that our president in Gonzaga has done in terms of wanting to become better at tribal relations, mm-hmm. understanding history, understanding geography, understanding the legacy in the movements of relationship between the Black Robes, the Society of Jesus, and the interior Salish Plateau Indian people of this area, mm-hmm. you know. I was instrumental in, and I don't even like to use that word, we put together the first job description that now our colleague Wendy Thompson occupies. Mm-hmm. And she remembers how many times that job description was rewritten and written. And it was under the diversity for many years, incubating there before we put it into mission. What people don't realize is I've reported to the president, I've reported to the VP for mission, and I've reported to the academic vice president, or now the provost. So I've done this, I don't like to say it this way, but I've done this kind of weaving, this drunk walk, or organizational speaking through the structures, trying, you know, where's Waldo, where's Raymond, mm-hmm. you know? And so I think though that first time I reported to Father Pat Lee when he was the VP for mission, I had this inspiration and this insight around linking inclusion, equity, and belonging to our mission. Mm-hmm. Because the Jesuits were about the intercultural encounter from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. Ignatius of Loyola and the seven original companions, they were about the intercultural encounter, the idea of enculturation. How is God working in this culture? So you can not only learn about, but you learn from. Mm-hmm. You know, that God's many manifestations, he, she, or it, is resonant in the ways of culture and language, and also power of place, the relationship to the earth in a certain place. So Salish Kootenai Reservation and Flathead Lake is going to be a different experience than the North Slope of the indigenous peoples in Alaska, or all indigenous peoples from all four directions on all the continents, you know? And so the Jesuits have always been about the intercultural encounter. We're sitting in this rare books room right now, and the archives, they've been about language and about botanicals. They wanted to know, how do people take care of themselves, the relationship to the botanicals, to the plant people. They also wanted to know, how do they communicate, you know, what their values are and how they communicate language. They've been about dictionaries and plants, is how I like to distill that. But those are some of the things but there's so many other things. The Institute for Action Against Hate was originally called, now it's Hate Studies. That was important. People don't know this, we had a diversity requirement in 1998. It morphed into the social justice requirement in 2001. Faculty Leadership Award for the spring, we started that in 2005. The Impact Groups, the Bridge Program out of Unity House. Unity House itself was midwifed and manifested out of the racism that happened in the law school in 1994-95, and we established that in 1997, the Unity House. There's just so many things that we've done. That the Multicultural Honor Society was established in 2010, Diversity Monologues. Well, and here again, not taking credit for any of this stuff, it was collaborative. This is one thing that I have loved about my journey at Gonzaga. It has been in relationship, goes back to the Margaret Wheatley quote, it's been in relationships that we've activated the full potential of what we could be doing in these areas with faculty, curriculum, recruitment, retention, campus climate. We, in 2007, we were considered rogues in 2007. Molly Pepper, myself, Matt Lasma, Linda Terlinek, did the first campus climate assessment. In fact, we were discouraged from doing that at one point, you know. And then finally, 2017, we hired Sue Rankin, and she came in and did it. And now we do it regularly, mm-hmm. through our CDO, Robin Kelly. So, I mean, we've done so, there's so many things to point to. Here again, some of them are, they had a shelf life, like life itself, a beginning, a middle, and end. Act 6 was a program that we did for many years. it served its purpose. Mm-hmm. I think it helped us to diversify. I think people would agree it helped us. It was a strategy that helped us diversify our student body, mm-hmm. now to 32-33% diverse. When I first came here, it was maybe, I'm going to say, 7-8% diversity.
Wow.
So, you know, got to work on our workforce, though, faculty mm-hmm. and staff, and we're doing that. From where I'm sitting, I think the future looks bright. We have all the ingredients. We have all the pieces in place. We just got to take everything to the next level mm-hmm. of refinement and quality.
I want to start to wrap up our time here together by sharing a lovely statement about you from someone else. I've been receiving a number of reflections from people across campus and in the community, and I chose one that was sent to me. I'll just read part of it. It's from Faculty Emeritus Blaine Garvin. He writes, "Over the years, Raymond has worked to help the rest of us to see the light, to appreciate the surprising openings our lives put in front of us, doors that lead to understanding and appreciation. We should listen to Raymond, who understands that we creative beings have found 1,000 ways through the thickets of our lives, paths that lead toward the good and the holy." That's a pretty beautiful expression on your behalf. So I'm grateful to Dr. Garvin for sharing that and for many others. And before I give you the final word, I just want to let our readers know that all of those sentiments and a whole collection of photographs and things that you have written and presentations that you've done will be available on the website at gonzaga.edu/Reyes. So that's pretty easy, gonzaga.edu/Reyes. And now I'm going to give you the final word.
Oh, man. My heart is so full right now, and it touches my tears. So much abundance, so much love, so much community. The final word would be what I often have closed many of my writings with or talks, and that is, in the spirit of our ancestors, may the blessings be. Mm.